Coming from the backwoods of New Jersey, welcome to the Jersey Guys Music Podcast, where we feature in-depth music discussions and interviews with special guests from the worlds of hard rock, heavy metal, and AOR music. So settle in and crank it up. Now, here are your hosts, the Jersey Guys themselves, Tom and Mark.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Jersey Guys podcast. I'm Mark Ballow here with my co-host Tom Coyne, as always. Today, we've got a special guest, two special guests actually joining us from the band Fighter Five out of Switzerland. We've got lead singer Emo Akar, and we've got the drummer Lucien Egloff. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks for having us.
You're welcome. Thank you. Thanks for your time today. So we wanted to start, and we talked about this a little bit before we started recording today. One of the things we like to do on our podcast here is at least once a month, we try to introduce some newer, young, you know, fresh bands that are coming out in the same sort of hard rock metal genre that we cover. And, you know, Fighter Five, you guys have two albums out now. 2019 was your debut. A little bit of a lineup change, the new singer and a couple other new guys in the band. We'll talk about that as we get along. But the new album came out about 5 months ago, and that's the brand new album, which is Heart of the Young, of course. So congratulations on the new album, guys. How's it been going so far?
Thank you, first of all.
Yeah, Emo.
Yeah, then I take the lead. Yeah, it's been going so far actually very good. We didn't really expect the way it is now. I mean, we could achieve a good progress, we could achieve a good development, and of course for every artist it is the aim to get with every album better and hopefully bigger. So the one we had now, the most difficult thing was, or the most important part was, to still have a good transition to the newer music, the new constellation, and still trying to keep that old sound of Fighter Five, even though it will be different people. So that was kind of like the point for us. And I think we could manage this by having also some old songs by the old singer, Dave Niederberger, who also supported us with some very good songs. And so it was. And we could achieve, like, also by bringing our own songs written by the new members. And the people seem to like it very much, and it could achieve quite a good success. And we're actually happy about it.
Before we kind of get into a little talk about the new album, I know Tom's got some stuff we're going to talk about, but Emo, I wanted to ask you, you're the new singer in the band. Give me a little bit about your background, because I did see that you were on The Voice TV show in Germany. Yeah. But talk a little bit about your background as a singer, maybe some influences, stuff like that.
Yeah, actually, I didn't start as a singer right from the start. It was, I began as a guitar player, and it kind of developed itself that I would also get into songwriting, try some new instruments and stuff. And I can remember this one certain situation. I was in a home recording studio of a good old friend of from the school days. And I wrote that one song, and it was about who's going to sing the song. And we were just looking at each other, who's going to sing it? And he was like, man, it's your song. You should maybe try it out. And so that was the first thing for me when I was then, I guess, 17 years old. And from then on, I tried to improve it, step by step. And I could do some good jobs here and there by joining as a choir singer, background singer, or live singer. And I also had the pleasure to work with some very, very cool artists. And then it came to the decision after some bands, as you may know. It's never the one band you have at the age where we are now. So I did have some other bands as well. But in the end, it was about, right, where you want to go. And I started, you know, thinking about going into the direction to join the Voice of Germany. And it was not about winning. It was not about achieving great success. It was about to, you know, establish yourself kind of like, because I was very young, I was 21. And I can remember there were people in the music scene in my city that would not know me or not appreciate, or I don't know. I was very young and I was kind of like still nobody. Mm. And after that, I really felt that I would get respect. I felt that people would, you know, take me serious. Mm. And so that was important in that case. And the other thing was, it's actually a very complex procedure you have with The Voice, since this whole thing is going for quite a time. Like it went almost for half a year till you were where you, you know, were on TV and stuff. I had some sort of juries over this period of time. And in the end, it was about, all right, like it was a luck thing, because you would have 3 days. And within those 3 days, it was about, all right, are the teams full or not? Because the first day, they would not buzzer this one button, because they would think, all right, I'm just going to check out the rest over the days without making my team full. And the second day, they buzzed like wild. And on the third day, most of the teams were full. So I can remember after me, there were six people still to come. And they took the last one. Although I won something called like an audition. That was called audience voting. Mm-hmm. So I won this, but it didn't really brought me anything. But still, it was a good experience for me. It was something I could show in the end when I applied for musical job.
Sure.
And then I did join a Whitesnake tribute band where I am till now. It's, I don't know, started with 21, 22, and now I'm 31. So this is something like a hard thing. I love Whitesnake and still going. And then I could, you know, cooperate with some artists, as I told before, that made me very proud of. And then I was still not, you know, I wanted to have a band again. I want to, you know, start something serious. And I came to Fighter Five. Those guys were promising a lot. They had the sound of Heat, which I really loved. And I loved the band Heat so much. So I thought, oh, that's a good band. And quite a time after, I just saw that they were looking for a new singer. I said, this is the chance for me. And I applied and I got the job. And since then, we are working, for everything else over the years now. Hmm. I don't know. It's maybe now 3 or 4 years where we are in. And but it still is like that I'm there for 1 year, you know. Time passes by so fast. But yeah, that's my influences. I love musicians like Michael Bolton, Jordan Turner, Jeff Scott Soto, Steve Overland, David Glenn Isley, and all those big legends, David Coverdale, Sammy Hagar.
Some good
still
ones.
I'm a big fan. Still I'm a kid somehow. And, yeah.
You just named all my favorite singers. So this question would be for Lucian. Now, the first album came out, got quite a bit of buzz at the time. What led to the upheaval in the terms that three original members left, three new members came in? When an album comes out and does well or does fairly well, you know, you see some continuity. What led to the change in the lineup?
You mean musically or in general?
Well, I mean, three original members were changed. Was that a change in direction with certain guys, or
I mean, in this time we had to change. Actually, we got a new album already in the pot, and we want to record. And then this happened with Dave, the former lead singer. And then so we had a lot of songs already there. So musically there was the red line, I say, was there. And then with the new members, we get some new influences. new styles. So we want to have this as well in the new album. So like a mix up between like older songs, as said, so and newer influences. And that was the magic what Mr. Plek, Thomas Plek, did in the studio, like to match everything together, that in the end you listen through the album and you have the red line and make sense from the beginning to the end. So I think you hear some difference between the songs, but in the whole picture it's all the same. So yeah.
Would you guys categorize yourself more in an AOR direction or more in an AOR direction? That's what I thought. So a little bit even more from the first album, because I revisited the new album yesterday, which I've listened to quite a few times, and there are a lot of songs that are almost more in an AOR direction. In fact, there's one song that has sax on it, which I love. I love, like, you know, I love, I don't like too much sax, but I think when it's put in the right places in certain songs, it really adds like a classy sound. So would you categorize yourself as like more of like a melodic rock / AOR type of band at this stage in time?
I would say yes.
Yeah. It is. We talked about this in a, when we came up with the second album, since this one is heavier, as you may heard. And for me, as a big fan of melodic rock and AOR, like this has a big variety on style, because then you have like more pop compromised AOR, or you have like a more funky one or more rock one. So since this has like a huge variety, we were thinking about, all right, where are we settled? And since the sound was a little heavier, we thought about, say, all right, it's more melodic hard rock. Like, you know, Whitesnake would do, you know, that the sound a little heavier, but still you would have lots of melody, lots of emotional parts and stuff, but still with a certain edge, still with the hard part, you know.
I even heard some songs that reminded me of the Coverdale Glenn Hughes period of Deep Purple.
Oh, yes. Which one?
One song in particular, Miracle Heart.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, the vocal phrasings it really reminded me of like the more, because if you listen to also those albums that Hughes and Coverdale were on, they were very varied. There were songs that were funky. There were songs that were real heavy. Yeah. There were songs that were AOR, you know, and I heard a couple of different things that reminded me of the Coverdale Hughes period of Deep Purple, which for me is a personal love.
Yeah, same here. It was like my one big influence when I started playing guitar, like Deep Purple. So I cannot let it go, you know, even though I wouldn't force it, because I really thought, right, you got to find your own thing in this album. You got to, you know, you have lots of influences here and there, but still got to be, you know, authentic and stuff. And people would still come up to me and say, oh, this is so Coverdale. I was like, I really didn't try to achieve that sound. It's like something, somehow I'm lucky to have a certain timbre, but I would never compare myself to him, of course. But still, it's a big blessing when people really come and hear your idea behind it out. Because we really had some reviews where people mentioned something like Red Dawn, Whitesnake, and stuff. And I was like, yeah, fuck, they really got it. They really understood what we wanted to achieve there. So I'm a huge, huge fan of Red Dawn and Coverdale and stuff. And people really get the parts out of the songs. It is like, for me, it's like they understand us, you know?
That's so awesome. Just as I got to Tom's house earlier today before we started, I said, you know, I was listening to the new album on the way down. And it hit me, and I said, I hear Larry Baud from Red Dawn. He's like, yeah, you know, that's good. So I wanted to ask you that, because I always thought, and you mentioned someone earlier, Jolyn Turner. I always thought Larry Baud had like that sort of Jolyn Turner, but a little huskier, you know?
Exactly the same. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. That's so funny.
So your vocals your vocals for me are a welcome addition into this scene of music, because it has, you remind me of a lot of classic USA singers in the sense that you have like a throatiness and like a beefiness to your voice.
Yeah.
There's a lot of like overdose of guys that sing really in the high register all the time. And, and while I like that and I appreciate the talent of it, there seems to be so much of it that everybody sounds the same and you don't have that
person. Yes.
You don't have that person. You hear Joe Lanterna sing, you hear Jeff Scott Soto sing three notes, you know it's them. And I find guys that have more of that a little bit of rasp, a little bit of beefier sound to their voice have their own personality. And your vocals seem to have that, which is nice. It's something, it's a welcome addition as to rather every guy that just sings, you know, super high.
Yeah, it's again what I said before. When people speak out of our minds, like I'm speechless, because you really nailed that. You really said what the topic or the problem is. I mean, there's so many great singers nowadays in that genre of music, but most of them, as you said, are sounding very similar without, you know, being rude on this. But, you know, you cannot change your timbre. You cannot, you know, try to sound completely different. You can do in a certain kind of era, but it's still like the voices being mostly auto-tuned or just, you know, thin voices. I wouldn't like it. I'm more the fan of, as you said, those raspy voices, a little bit of soul note, you know.
Yes.
And so this is what mostly catches people, when you have some passion, when you have some balls in it, you know.
Right.
And I was like, why not doing both, man? Why not doing the soul-y, bluesy stuff and still hitting those high notes? And then you have the total, the full approach.
And I think it really came through in the video, Heart to Heart. That video, Heart to Heart, is just, you know, it really comes across, that style of singing coupled with the sound of what has now become the signature sound of Fighter Five. I think that video really was a great introduction to people of this is what the band sounds like now. And it was shot really well. It's a terrific video. It's really,
yeah,
I think
I,
one
I,
of,
I,
yeah. I'd
eye.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd eye. It's one of the, I think, better videos I've seen in a long time. If both, like Lucian, even you could chime in, how did that video go? Was that like a big production to get that together?
Yeah, it's quite, actually, Power was intenser, the pre-production, because all of this, I don't know if you saw the music video of Power. It was this with the flipper machine.
Yes.
Yeah. And that we had a lot of pre-production because of, we actually had to do like there was this screen on the machine, and we wrote only for this machine or for this clip, we had to film or edit like this screen there. And then you have in the pre-production, you have to do all timeline through the whole song, like where has to be the score, et cetera, et cetera. And then it was really intense. For Eye to Eye, pre-production wasn't so intense, but on set there was more to do because actually, there where we filmed the music video was a cave.
Really?
We need we need a room who's dark during the day and have some points where we can hang all the light stuff up. And yeah, we had to organize a ring, like a boxing ring. And all the light and all the stuff. And yeah, and it was really cold as well because it was a cave.
Right.
and it was like in November, I guess.
Wow.
But we was pretty happy. I mean, the crew, we worked together. They did a great job. The camera guy, he did some really cool shots, like really good movements. And the best scene, if you can remember, or next time if you see it, it's the start of the guitar solo, because on this spot, the light begins to move. Before it was still, and then on the first hit of the guitar solo, it begins to move, and the camera do it as well.
Mm.
And it pushes really well, like the, how do you say, the drama of the whole music video. And we really appreciate it if someone looks the music video through and enjoy it, because we like this kind of expression, or you can express your music on not only with music, with some pictures as well. And nowadays, I mean, no one did a lot of, only the big ones, they do really big production, but the small one, it's always, it costs a lot.
Yeah.
Then in the end, it's like, for YouTube, doesn't matter. Yeah, we do something.
Mm.
And then it's like, only content, but not like art. And we really, really like this kind of art, or the way you can express yourself.
Well, it came across as big production. I mean, it was really a cut above. And what I liked about it is it kind of is your, like, it's the personality of the band. I notice with a lot of young bands, I check out YouTube videos all the time with young bands. Too many bands are trying to do videos that are reminiscent of like 1988 in the States or 1987. Mm-hmm. And it kind of comes across like cheesy. It doesn't look like 2025. It just looks like young guys trying to act like it's 1988. Mm-hmm. This mm-hmm. video, it doesn't like that. It's like there's a lot of energy, and there's just like a lot of your own personality, and you're not trying to look like an era from 30 or 40 years ago. It's just there's just a lot of energy caught on the video, and that's what I really liked a lot about it.
I mean, we know a lot of old music videos and all the style.
You know what I'm talking about without mentioning names, right?
yeah. And I mean, we love this kind of music. We love the style. We love this era. And for us, it's always like, take the strong message of this era, or the spirit, and take the essence of it and put it through and try to do something like nowadays.
Sure.
Put it through the lens of 2024.
Something
I agree.
Like that. Not that it has to be cheesy. Not that it looks like cheesy. Or if you do it, then you have to go full in. Really cheesy.
Right.
But we don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Now
you don't want to be full on Steel Panther or anything like that.
No, I mean Steel Panther did it or does it?
Yeah.
Because there was one of the first ones.
Yeah.
Like, and then it stand for themselves. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. When you do that as well, then you are kind of a ripoff.
Yeah. Yeah.
True. Wait, there's a few bands right now that I always say this too. It's very difficult to take the good elements of that era and not make it sound dated in 2024, 2025. And there is some bands that's pretty much how I gauge bands that I get into, the ones that are able to do it. There's a band called Invasion. I don't know if you guys are familiar with them. We've had them on the show.
Okay.
They're right up there with you guys in terms of the way they're doing it. And another band called Daytona. That's
yes. I know them.
Those guys, they got it down too. They really, they are spot on, you know, like you guys, like doing it like old school, but through the lens of today.
Yeah, modernized.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But it's hard to, there aren't that many bands doing it because it's not an easy thing to do. I think it's, I mean, you guys are the musicians, but to me, it seems like it's easier just to try to, you know, dress and act and shoot videos and write cheesy songs than it is to really do stuff that's intelligent, but with that energy and feel from the late 80s.
It is indeed very, very complicated, because like when you try to do melodic rock nowadays, it is always a fucking compromise. It's just a matter of how much compromise, because this old 80s sound lives from huge hall rooms, you know, lives from all that cheesy sound. And you cannot say, all right, I'll do an 80s album and dry an adult all, you know, and have a dry snare sound, have a dry this and that, because you need that atmosphere. You need that room. This makes it legendary. It's the same on vocals. Like when you ask me, I'm still like, yeah, maybe we would have needed a little more reverb on the vocals, but it's like a tasting still. But it's, you know, because when you would take those great albums, like, I don't know, Jolin Turner's solo album where Rescue You and stuff was on, when you really take the reverb, it will not sound as legendary as we know of Jolin Turner. So it's the difficult part to make this possible nowadays without getting into that cheesy thing. And there are indeed some bands that can manage it, but it is hard because it's always, you know, you always have to compromise things out. And always, okay, then we have to let this out. You know, we got to be more commercially here and there. So it was also for us a big topic, only just the snare sound, you know. We had a very good snare sound, but then we're still not happy with it. We still want to have a punch, still wanted to have a good reverb on it still, but not too cheesy, but still a little cheesy. So it's always compromising.
One of the most underrated things is the snare drum sound. I mean, yes. There are so many records over the years that get ruined by a bad snare drum, you know. Yes. And to this day, there's records I put on. And then sometimes even after the course of decades, you go back and you listen to something and you say, geez, this is such a good album. That snare drum sound is so fucking annoying. Like, how did they not? And then you get a great snare drum sound and it just drives the whole record. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's like paying attention to things like that is for the listener is very important.
Well, how do you guys, the recording process with the band, how is that done? I mean, we talk about, you know, this, you're saying the sounds and this and that. Back in the day, in the 80s, I mean, you had bands with huge budgets, record labels, you know, these studios. How do you guys, what is your recording process? Do you guys go into a good pro studio, or is it something where you guys are working from home studios and stuff like that?
We did it the old school way.
Yes.
That's great. Good. It shows.
Big amps, big everything, big money, everything. But not a label to support us, unfortunately.
Well, that's why I asked. Yeah. Well, I asked because the way you talked about it, that's what I'm wondering, if that's what you guys did.
Yes, exactly how it was.
Actually, we was 4 weeks, I guess. Mm-hmm. We was in Sweden.
Okay.
We went to Sweden to a studio. Actually, guitar player and Emo was there for the whole 4 weeks there. And me and Roman, bass player, we was 2 weeks there.
Okay.
And then at first drums, then bass, guitar, keys, vocals. Yeah. Was really intense.
You've gotten Japanese deals on both of these, and the more recent one has an exclusive Japanese bonus track, which in today's day and age is a rarity. Usually people give acoustic tracks or, you know, some bullshit track, but you actually gave them this song No Surrender, which is a song that's worthy to be on the regular album. How did that come about? Did they hold your feet to the fire for that song, or
other question? You know the record, you know the normal record and mm-hmm. the Japanese record, and if you're writing through all the titles, if you see another song who probably can be on the Japanese record,
yes, of course, the Tokyo
Radio song. Tokyo, yeah.
Yes,
through that, and actually, one idea was like put this on the Japanese record and make
and reel the Japanese in with that song.
Yeah. Yeah, like this and a year after the release come out with a Japanese special edition, something mm-hmm. like that. But that didn't work out, or like we thought in the end the song was so strong, like Radio Tokyo was so strong, we need this one as a single as well.
Mm. So you basically flipped out a song that should have been on the album and what was supposed to, yep. Okay, I see. That
kind of like compromise in a
right,
way.
Right.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
So what has been, we know you were on the road with Axel Rudi Pell. What was that like?
Awesome. It was, I mean, like for a support band, you can't imagine a better main act to work with, really.
Well, that was a long time coming, though, right? Because you guys were supposed to do that a couple years ago, right? And everything got kind of pushed down because of the pandemic.
Yes, yes, yes. Everything was postponed, and yeah.
And Emma, what was it like to be exposed to a guy that we were just talking about when it comes to raspy, throaty vocals, a legend, Johnny Gioli?
He was actually a very, like, to be honest, I have ADHD, but this guy is way crazier. Like, he like, the first time for me, it was very, very special because I'm a big fan of Hardline and also the work he did here and there. And yeah, it was a great pleasure. It was an honor. And then I just realized, dude, that dude is just fucking insane.
Yeah, he puts forth the same energy on stage that he did 25 years ago when he first joined Pell. He's been with Pell
crazy,
forever.
Man. Crazy. Yeah, he still, what I don't understand, he still has the same timbre. Like, he didn't age anything. And I was just in shock. And he was a very fun guy. It was very, very, yeah, it was a challenge, of course, you know, sticking up to this. But it was very cool. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you guys, it's a couple songs because Tom and I were talking about this before we went on air and started. I got to ask, and either one of you can take it, but like, talk about a song like Speed Demon. It's one that just jumped out at me as a favorite right off the first listen. Can anybody share a little thoughts about that?
Yeah, I can tell about it. We were sitting in the rehearsal room, and it was about, I mean, we all are kind of car fans, you know, old timers and stuff, and we all adrenaline freaks, and it we couldn't, you know, let go on writing another fast lane speed song. And then it was about that song. Roman, my bass player, had the idea of this intro with the guitar, the diddle, 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 and then it was about arrangement, it was about building it up and doing it epic. And then I did some chord changes here and there, tried to, you know, build it up, as I said. And then it was about the chorus. And I can remember, I just sat on the couch and I was like, hey man, let's maybe do some kind of epic by just letting the chord swing. It was some kind of, the influence was a little Burn by Deep Purple.
Well, yeah, I was going to say Deep Purple Rainbow. It had that feel right from the start. And that's what kind of caught my attention, you know?
Yeah, because like when you let something just, you know, when you play, you know, a note on the bass guitar, and there were so many songs where I just realized people just letting, for example, Billy Sheehan, just letting the notes be hold, you know, it's bam, without do-do-do-do-do.
Yeah.
And this is what made it so epic. And I was the thought, okay, let's really keep it very simple and push it over this, make it epic over just letting the chord stay there. And then, with the vocals going very high and stuff, and then in the chords again, the driven part and stuff. So that was a little the idea, making very very simple chords there. And then I was about the solo part, and I wanted to have some kind of Yngwie Malmsteen part there and try to do some harmonic stuff in the end, a little more classic influence, and did a good ending. So I forced my guitar player to play like Yngwie there. I was like, you gotta do fucking Yngwie Malmsteen. I was like, for real? Yes. Okay, I'm in. And he really did it. It was crazy. It was we were at the studio. I guess it was indeed one take. Wow. Like we did, it was not the first, but, or maybe it was the first. I'm not sure. He did one take and it was insane. It was out of nothing. Like he didn't know in the end what he did. It was like, what the fuck did I do there? It was, I don't know. I cannot reproduce it. I was like, fuck it. It's good. So just did that. Maybe we took here another part, mixed it up with the ending or so, but like towards the end where it was going crazy, we let it as it was. So that was to the song. Yeah,
nice.
Well, Deep Purple kind of set the standard for those songs with Speed King and Highway Star.
Yes, yeah. Yes, yeah, yes.
I mean,
yes,
you know,
yes.
Speed King was like at that time was like, you know, that song came out in 70. There was that was like one of the heaviest songs that were ever recorded at the time.
Or even you go to Rainbow with Death Alley Driver, something
Death
like
Alley
that.
Driver, yeah. Right. Yeah, I mean, that was definitely Blackmore's influence on all those songs also.
Yeah.
I wanted to just go back to the Axel Rudy Pell and ask Lucian, was Bobby Rondinelli the drummer on this tour?
It was, yeah.
So what was it like for you to be with, in my opinion, one of my all-time favorite drummers and a guy that is literally a legend?
He is a really legend. I mean, how old is he? Like,
Bobby is got to be at least 65 or 66, 67, somewhere around there. Yeah.
Yeah. And he wasn't so fit, walking like, but if he's behind the drum, it's like crazy. It's like, I mean, like he was playing like a youngster.
Wow.
It was so inspiring to see that. And we had some chats together, and he's like, said, I mean, he don't have to do that. I mean, but he likes it, and he has this passion, and he want keep the fire alive. So, yeah. And I mean, always, I think if you get in touch with other musicians and they have, after so many years, still the passion, the fire in them, like it's so inspiring.
Yeah, Bobby was a very, I always liked Bobby's drumming. He had a lot of tasty fills. Like he didn't overplay, but when he had to overplay, he was as good as anybody. And there was a lot of drummers from that, you know. There was Joe Franco, was another drummer from Long Island, part of New York, that produced a lot of these type of real heavy end drummers.
I got to see Bobby Rondinelli with Black Sabbath in Germany in 1995.
Yeah, that's right. He toured on the Cross Purposes tour.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's insane.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And his playing was so effortless. Like,
I know.
The only effort was the walking. The walking was more effort than the playing.
Really?
There was a guy holding the light for him to get on stage. It was like, fuck, where am I? He was so, it was
that's
too
funny.
Too sweet to see him.
So you guys basically were exposed to two tremendous USA legends in Gioli and Rondinelli.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that had to be quite a thrill to be sharing the stage with guys like that for both of you, I would think.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, and that there was such kind people, all of them. All the whole crew. I mean, normally, like, we are a support act, so
right,
nobody cares about the support act, of course, because they are the main band. But it wasn't like that. It was like we are a whole family, and we are together on this tour, and to do our job together and enjoy ourselves on stage. So it was really awesome.
And the keyboard player and the bass player, I've been with him for, I think they were like friends from school. That's how far they go back with him. It's a very unique band. We never get to see them in the States because he doesn't tour over here. But I've always been a fan from the very first record that had Charlie Yoon was the singer.
Charlie Yoon. I love him.
Me too. Yeah. Me too. He was the singer on the very first album.
Of Victory also. I love the work he did on Victory.
And speaking of Victory, that was another singer that remind me a little bit was Fernando Garcia.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I heard that as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, I was listening to the album on the headphones yesterday, and there were little voice, you know, phrasings that I heard similar to Garcia, which was that guy was a great singer back in the day.
I got to check him out because shame on me, I didn't really... I guess I heard one song or two since someone said the same like you, but I've really never checked it out. So I got
to
do it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Listen to all the albums that great singer.
Another song I want to ask you guys about, and whoever can take it, Stepped on a Landmine. Kind of a funny title, but a great song. Talk a little bit about that if you can.
There was a song I wrote before I knew Fighter Five even. That I did the song... kind of like it was a crossover between the good old 70s riffing, what you would know from the Purple and Rainbow and stuff, like the Richie Blackmore work on the guitar. But I wanted to, you know, make a 70s meets 80s by adding the double bass to it, the drums. So they had like the classic 70s riff, and then bam, bam, you know, they have the heaviness of the drums. So that was the thing. And then it was about the chorus, and I wanted to have some very, very epic, dangerous choirs. And it was like, all right, let's do a choir-centered chorus, which I love. I got to say, I really love songs where the choirs are centered, not because I'll be too lazy to sing them live, but it really gives a huge impact, gives a huge atmosphere to the songs when you have a huge choir pushing, like on Def Leppard and stuff. So that was the thing for this. And I died doing this fucking choirs, but still we would have three additional more background singers, three or four more, and could get them to it as well. And the choirs were just fucking epic, you know. And in the end, it was a good old classic rock and roll, dirty rock song.
Yeah.
Yeah. With some show off moments on the vocals. I was like, I need that one song where I totally go insane. And then towards the end, it was like, all right, fuck it, let's do the very, very high ones.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, the master thing to sing in the end, but it went very well.
Yeah. Now, great song.
I wanted to take you through one song. We're not going to bring you guys through every single song, but my favorite song on the album is Miracle Heart. You too. Lucian, you could tell me how that song came together. That to me is an epic song. That to me is really captures like the greatness of like a band like Giant. Huge favorite of mine.
Yeah, same. I love Giant.
Yeah. It's got that type of sound to it. How do you guys come up with a tune like that good in the year 2024?
It was a song from Emo, and it came with that, and we thought, oh, we need that on the record. Because, like, it's totally different, kind of. And for me, my part that I really into is, like, the middle part before the guitar solo starts. Like, then it breaks everything down, and then you have only like the kick hits, like the beat, like the heartbeat is pumping, yes. And then it's rises up like into the guitar solo, and I love it so much.
Yeah, it's really an incredible song.
But it's such a shame till now we don't play the live.
Oh no,
really?
We hadn't got time. I mean, we felt like if we play live, then we nail it. We have to nail it really hard.
Okay.
Like, it's with so much feel, and then you have to do it live.
Yeah, well, that's a pure AOR song.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, like real vintage USA mid-80s, late-80s song.
Yeah. And so we hadn't got time till now to rehearse it for live.
We got to work it out during rehearsal or during sound checks or something. You fleshed it out and then you could add it to the set.
Yeah. I mean, that was so awesome for the European tour. We played the set for 17 times, and we can change something, add another song, or skip one, or try something out for live performance. And that was really good, because you can discuss something and the next day you can do it on stage. And it, like, you can rehearse so much, but like play it live, that's always another page.
Yep. I wanted to ask you guys about you guys are, you know, from Switzerland. What is the scene like? Because Tom and I were talking about this prior to coming on. You know, you have a Gotthard. You have bands like, obviously, Crocus. China is one we talked about. What is the scene like in Switzerland for hard rock nowadays?
It's not so big.
Okay. Well, I mean, you know,
don't feel so bad. It's not so big in the United States either.
That's true.
Thankfully, there are countries that it is big.
But I mean, in Germany, it's quite bigger because the German is quite big as well. I mean, in Switzerland, you have a good rock scene, and they are really how do you say, like, really into it, but it's not so big.
Okay.
Like the main audience, they're listening to pop music.
Yeah, we got like a cult followings of, you know, the hard rock, the melodic hard rock, the 80s influence stuff. So there's probably a fan base of that. That's a small fan base, but someone that's into it.
Yeah. Like you see, you see always the same faces in front of the stage, but we appreciate it really. I mean, it's awesome, but it's so, like, it's a family.
Yeah.
Everyone knows everyone. Like, it's the same with the bands.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is kind of the nature of hard rock music, though. I mean, I've been involved with it since the 70s, and most of the eras have been an underground following. You know, you had your small periods of time where there were some explosions of bands that became big, but for every band that became big, there were, you know, 100 great bands that were far from big. You know, and we talk about this with a lot of other artists back in the day too, how many great bands I saw in clubs, and Mark as well. And, you know, there'd be 100, 150 people there. And these were bands signed to major labels back in the day too. So we always kind of had a, you know, a cult underground following to it, this music. It's just kind of the nature.
How big is the scene in the USA? Because you said mostly of your listener, they are from Europe, right?
It's not, what's big in USA is a lot of the older bands that are still touring with maybe one original member, maybe two, maybe none. And you have the name, like, you know, people will hear this band, that band, they identify, you know, like with a 38 Special or Styx or REO Speedwagon. So you'll get the people in their 50s and their 60s that'll go into the, you know, the festivals and all the big outdoor shows in the summertime. But as far as the younger bands, there's little pockets of places, like in Brooklyn, New York has a scene, but it's more of a metal scene than like a melodic rock AOR scene. It's more of a traditional metal scene. It's pretty vibrant. A lot of clubs get packed. But it's a small area. No, it's more like pockets of, you know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like it's not as vibrant as it was in the middle 80s to early 90s. It's not like on that level, unfortunately.
Well, before we let you guys go, what's ahead for 2025 for Fighter Five?
Yeah, we had some festival shows ahead. We have it's. During spring, we can support Neurosis for some shows. Like there are six shows with Neurosis and all in Germany. Because I mentioned like Germany is a really big rock scene. So
yeah, big metal scene, right?
Yeah.
Are you doing any festivals with the helicopters?
No, with the helicopters.
Yeah. No. Okay. I'm a big fan of another band that never plays over here. I've been a lifelong fan. I've never seen them, and I'd see that they came out with a new album. They're playing like every big festival in Europe. So I was just curious if you were on any bills with them.
Yeah, and we do some songwriting right now, working on new stuff. So,
well, that's interesting. That's good to hear.
Good. Yeah, well, I mean, it's only been, 5 months since the new album's out, Heart of the Young, so you got a little bit of time, right?
We're not rushing you.
it is like, for an outstanding youth, you think like, oh, they got time, but you cannot imagine how fast things are, or you really have to deliver things before, till you can drop them, as you may know. So we are actually, we have to be quick. But we're good, and it's just, you know, it is always like when it comes to songwriting and comes to the album part, you don't have a life anymore because you sit just home, and you know, when you can shower, then you're lucky. So that's how it goes all the time now, like working, getting back home, songwriting. Next day, if we can do, repeat it. And but it's all worth it when you have in the end such great opportunities, getting awesome reviews, interviews and stuff, getting chances to tour with others, then you know, all right, that was all worth it.
Yeah.
Now, you've definitely gotten the attention of a lot of people. I network with a lot of people constantly talking, and everybody's got like a very good vibe about this album, like very positive. So
yeah, it was crazy. Yeah, we really got really, really very good reviews. I didn't expect this to be that good.
Yeah, no, it's you really got something to build on this album.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. All right. Well, hey, Lucien, Emo, we appreciate it. Fighter 5, Heart of the Young, brand new album. Check it out, guys. Thanks for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks so much.
It was a lot of fun.
Thanks a lot.
Good talking to you.
We'll stay in touch.
Yeah. All right.
And we'll promote
your
thank you. And we'll promote your socials.
Oh, yeah.
And everything.
And you know what? I got to, while we're on the air, the merch is, as you can see by my hoodie, is top shelf. It's one of the softest, coolest hoodies that I own. So,
perfect.
Yeah, it's top quality.
I have to order one myself.
Yeah, it is. We do really quality on everything.
No, right down to on the strings, the little with the logo name, right? And that's cool. I don't have one hoodie, and I got about 100 of them that has that. So anybody who hasn't bought any merch, get to it.
That's right.
Yeah. Actually, the leather that's recycled. So
there you go
on it and. And we did all this engraving, laser engraving by ourselves.
Really?
Wow, really?
Yeah. We did do a lot of stuff by ourselves.
Like, yeah, great selection of stuff on the website. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Because we say always, like, we want to wear it as well. So
Yes.
No, you did a good job. It's super soft, very comfortable. And, and I got it right away. I didn't have to wait 6 months. Like, I wait for some things from certain bands.
This
takes so long, I forgot I even ordered them. Things come in the mail, like, oh.
Okay, awesome.
No, I got it right away.
Yeah, but sometimes we had bad luck, and then some parcel didn't arrive because of shipping.
Sure. Yeah.
But yeah.
Yep.
Well, okay, awesome.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate your time today.
All right, take care, guys. We'll be in touch.
All right.
Have a nice day, guys.
Bye.
Thank
you. See you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.